Today's Teisho will be on Case 63 and the Book of Serenity. Case 63 is entitled Zhao Zhou Asks About Death. Introduction. Sansheng and Zhuifeng were spring orchids, autumn chrysanthemums. Zhao Zhou and Tuzhe were the gem of Bian, the gold of Yan. On a markless balance, both sides are even. In a bottomless boat, they cross in one place. When the two meet, what then? Case. Zhao Zhou asked Tuzhe, when someone who has undergone the great death then returns to life, how is it? Tuzhe said, he can't go by night. He should arrive in daylight. Verse. The seed castle, the Aeon rock, subtly exhausting the beginning. The living eye in the ring illuminates vast emptiness. Can't go by night. Arrive by the dawn's light. The sound of the family couldn't be entrusted to goose or fish. Thank you so much for doing an excellent job this morning in the Zendo. You know, everybody is doing an excellent job, I would say. People are coming into the Dokusan room with really hard-earned responses. You know, the work of Zen practice is encountering our obstacles and moving through them. And it's really wonderful. Really wonderful to see people do this wholeheartedly. You know, wholeheartedly. People are coming into the Dokusan room and presenting their responses in ways that show that they have been willing to turn themselves inside out, really. And that's quite impressive. Really wonderful. It's not always like that. You know, many years ago, I had a student. This was when we were just getting started, you know. At one time, we would have like five or six people at a sesshin. And we used to do sesshin at my house. And we were sitting in the same room in Lucy Stone Hall. People would come to sit and come, and maybe they would try a few sits and then they would go away, but gradually a small group of people collected and we started to do sesshin at my house. And there was one man, who was fairly early on, he would come to sit every week. And then he would come to sesshin. But he would come into the Dokusan room, and I would say, I'd give him a call on, and I'd say, what do you have to say? What's going on? And he said, I've got nothing. I don't have anything to say right now. And then another day would go by, and he'd come in, and so what's going on? Nothing to report. So next day, nothing to report. And the session would be over. So, you know, I didn't expect to see him back, but he'd be back at the session again. Nothing to report, nothing to report. And, you know, he practiced with me for 4 years, and I never really, I know nothing about him, you know. It's not so important that I know nothing about him, but that it was just this great conundrum to me that he was able to get into Mushin, but he just stayed in Mushin. sort of a frozen in Wuxin. And no matter what koan I gave him, he would just stay in that blank place. And it was surprising to me. I really didn't know what to do. You know, one day I was having lunch with a friend of mine who's a psychotherapist, and he was talking to me about some of his clients, and he talked to me about a patient who had come to see him, and the guy would hardly talk, and whatever happens in Dokusan is strictly confidential, and I never talk about it to anybody. I did say to my friend, however, I said, you know, there was a guy in our Zen group who used to come, and every time he would come into Dokusan, he would say, I've got nothing to show you. And I said, I've been stumped. Do you have any insight? And he said, yeah. He said he wants you to do the work. See? He wants you to do the work. He doesn't want to do the work. He wants you to make it happen, like, magically, right? So, you know, that explains a lot, because, you know, this guy kept coming, and so something motivated him to come. You know, he was hurting, maybe. I don't know. He was hurting. He was confused, whatever, but he never shared with me. And I thought maybe it was my fault. You know, if I just said, you know, I would try different things. You know, let me try this, let me try that. Nothing, 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 nothing. So, you know, finally, you know, he left. It makes sense, you know. And I never felt like I could be helpful to him. But my friend, the therapist, said, you know, really, he was waiting for you to do the work for him. And maybe his client was like that, his patient was like that. The guy would come in, he would wait for the therapist to solve his problems, and of course, nothing would happen. So, you know, you have to do the work on the cushion. You know, you have to be willing to turn yourself inside out, so to speak. You know, in the koan collections, this is called like showing. This is, he showed him his guts, you know. That's one way to put it. But, you know, that kind of willingness to be open with another person is complicated, right? I mean, maybe my student didn't trust me. You know, that's possible. But I think it might also be the case that he didn't trust, you know, the process, didn't trust the process, and didn't trust himself. You know, so that's complicated. You know, people have to be willing to come in, and it's true, you know, you have to be willing to say something about yourself that's somewhat revelatory. You know, you're revealing something. And I promise you I would never say anything to anybody. I don't discuss it with anybody. You know, it also takes a great deal of courage to be willing to open yourself up, right? I mean, we create a self which is, you know, a carefully managed bundle of contradictions, right? You know, we create a self, you know, that's sort of a functional system, right? You know, it works. We get through school. We have relationships, you know, and they more or less work, right? You know, and so, you know, we create an image of ourselves, which is, you know, generally, you know, the best image we can create. And we might, you know, have several different images of ourselves. There's the image of ourselves that we like to think about. There's an image of ourselves that we keep tucked away, which is less positive, you know. But we go through life, you know, playing the game of being Kurt or playing the game of being Susan, and yet, you know, things happen to us that cause us a lot of suffering, And maybe at some point we decide to try meditation. And it takes a lot of courage to be willing to unpack yourself, right, on the cushion. And you know, that's so, I mean, that really takes guts. That really does take guts. And so I applaud you all for having that kind of courage to go through that process. You know, Zen practice is about, you know, encountering our obstacles, and that means we have to admit we have obstacles, right? And for some people that's very difficult. You know, I definitely have met people who, didn't want to deal with their obstacles. You know, I remember, I trained with Genki Roshi at the Seattle Zen Center, and he was unfailing. I thought, when I did Dokusan with him, he was unfailingly kind and supportive. You know, I know that there are teachers who can be somewhat critical of their students, you know, but Genki was never like that. He was always warmly supportive, and he never played the role of calling me on my bullshit. You know, he pretty much let me find it out for myself, right? And he was just this very wonderful, gentle mentor. Yeah. But I remember there was a coffee shop in Seattle, the Allegro Coffee Shop, which is still there. And I used to know the owner, Andy Shiga, because my wife Barbara worked for Mr. Shiga. And I would go and have coffee there sometimes after teaching. And there was a guy who worked in the coffee shop named Nathan. And I had seen Nathan at a session a couple times. And I said, what happened? You're not doing Zen anymore? And he was really angry. And he said, you know, I don't need Genki Roshi to tell me, you know, how enlightened I am, you know, or something like that. And I just wondered where that was coming from. But I think maybe he felt very threatened by the process, right? I mean, I too got into Zen thinking this was a technology of consciousness. You know, I would sit on the cushion, the teacher. I mean, I literally thought that. I thought that, you know, basically that, you know, I would go into a room and Genki Roshi would say, okay, now do this. And, you know, my mind would start glowing or something, and now do this. And then something else would happen. And then, you know, the next secret, and my brain waves would be shifting from alpha to beta to delta, you know. And this was very much in the air. You know, if you read, you know, people were doing all this. One of my best friends, John Sunson, was a brain researcher. And he was one of the first people who used to hook people up to read their brain waves. And they noticed that when people did meditation, you know, their brain waves changed. And in a very famous study, a person went to a Japanese temple and said, I want you to rate your students from most advanced to least advanced. And the Roshi went, bing, 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 bing. And then they wired him up and they found that the one who was most advanced had the most pronounced brain, you know, alpha waves or something, or delta waves. And the others were sort of, hit and miss, you know, at the other end of the line. So lots of people were thinking this is a technology of consciousness that will magically solve my problems for me. And a similar thing happened with LSD, by the way. There was a very famous man named Aldous Huxley. And Huxley was from a very, very distinguished British family. His grandfather was a friend of Charles Darwin, and was a journalist and scientist, and he was one of the most distinguished champions of evolution in the West, evolutionary science, and the Huxley family were, you know, pretty wealthy, pretty upper crust British people, and And when Aldous Huxley was a teenager, his older brother blew his brains out with a gun. And Huxley lost vision. After that, his vision was never right. You know, so Huxley had a shadow cast over his life, you know. His parents had incredibly high expectations for him, and his brother, obviously, and his brother checked out. And so, you know, Huxley went through a long journey in his life. He became a very famous novelist, but he also had this interest in Vedanta and Buddhism, and he was one of the early experimenters with LSD. And if you ever read his book, Opening the Doors of Perception, it's a wonderful book because Huxley says, you know, I took, so many milligrams of lysergic acid and my world was opened up, you know. And all these kids in college read this book. It's like, okay, sign me up, right? You know, one pill and we're Buddha, you know. How great is that, you know? So, I myself was from a generation that saw how destructive all this turned out to be. You know, I had a lot of friends who were dropping acid all the time, and many of them developed really severe personality disorders. Some people had, you know, psychotic breaks. You know, it was not Huxley's world. You know, Huxley was a very intelligent, he had done years of meditative practice. When he dropped LSD, he was listening to like Beethoven or something, you know, very cultured man, you know, very brilliant guy. You know, when all these, you know, 17-year-olds were dropping acid and listening to Black Sabbath, you know, they didn't have that experience, you know. So it's definitely the case that people misunderstood. And they wound up in very, very bad places because they were naive about what the cultivation of mind is all about. This also is true in the Buddhist world. You know, it's not a technology. You can't just plug yourself into alpha waves. And you still see that kind of thing. You'll see in Psychology Today magazine, somebody's selling a brainwave machine. And you can, you know, instead of spending all this time at Sesshin, you can hook yourself up for 5 minutes a day and get enlightened, right? You know, so it's not like that. You have to do the work, and everybody is doing the work. You know, you have to be willing to put yourself on the line. Transformation process is something you have to initiate yourself. You know. In Zen, people understand how difficult it is to really change yourself. How difficult it is to do that. You know, when in classical Zen tradition, people talk about sitting on the cushion or at Sesshin as dying on the cushion. Dying on the cushion. And when I first started practicing Zen, you know, I thought that just meant having pain in my legs, right? In fact, we used to joke about it, you know. After a day of sitting, we'd all be limping back to the bunkhouse. And I would say to my friend Bill Kugler, "How are you doing?" And he'd go, "Dying on the cushion." That's what we thought Genki Roshi meant. Dying on the cushion meant, boy, I'm really dying here, you know. But that actually, the pain in your legs is the easy part, to tell you the truth. You know, if you're just getting started, that may sound discouraging, right? But the easy part is the pain in your legs. I mean, sitting, you know, as I mentioned earlier, the seated posture is best for many, many different things. It affects your endocrine system. It changes the way your brain is functioning. The human body is, you know, this very finely calibrated device for producing an enlightened state of mind. So you know, when we sit on the cushion, even though it's challenging physically, we're doing very, very necessary things. And also, you know, when you're dealing with pain, that's really quite important. You know, if you run away from pain, you'll run away from everything in life, you know. So when people, you know, are dissuaded from doing Zen because their legs hurt, well, I have the feeling that they have been responding that way to other things in their life. You know, pretty much everything you do in life causes you pain. You know, the Buddha said, you know, life is suffering. You know, he also said there's a way out of suffering. But, if you decide to go to graduate school, you can look forward to a lot of pain, you know. If you decide to work in any company in America, plenty of pain, right? You know, if you want to be an athlete, pain. You know, artist, pain. You know, there's many different kinds of pain, right? So there's something really elemental about just sitting with pain in your legs and not running away. And you focus on the breath and you sweep your pain away. And as you're doing this, you drop down into samadhi, into a deeper state of mind. And it's definitely a struggle. It's definitely a struggle, you know. Part of your body is saying, run away. You know, you're part of your mind is saying, what, are you crazy? Get out of here. Oh, you know, and you're overriding that. But when you override that impulse by focusing like a flashlight on the breath, you descend into deep samadhi. You know, and in deep samadhi, you know, you're not in the same sort of egotistical, self-centered consciousness. You still are thinking in your own self, or thinking in your own I or me, but you're much less caught in the illusion of yourself. You know, your thoughts become fewer and farther between. You're more open to and receptive to things around you. Like when you hear a bird, you feel like you're, as we talked about earlier in the week, you know, you feel, when you hear a bird, you feel that you are the bird. So samadhi is, from the Buddhist standpoint, a more open and actually sane state of mind. And it's necessary to get there remain there for long periods of time in order to work through our obstacles. So, you know, it's true. Sitting on the cushion and having pain in your legs is kind of a little bit like dying. Yeah, but you know, the great death is in Zen is going into mushin. So you know, if you're working on the breath, perception, koan, you're following the breath out, on the out-breath, you'll notice that at the end of the breath, at some point, your mind is becoming very blank. And this blank mind is what we call in Zen, mushin, emptiness mind, okay? Now, this at first seems just sort of trivial, you know, or can seem trivial. You know, you might be sitting on the cushion, you're watching the breath, and all of a sudden there's nothing. And, you know, when this first happens to people, they can be puzzled. You know, many people have powerful imaginations, you know. So when some people sit, you know, at first they see colors, or they have beautiful images or memories come up, and they're very vivid, you know. And, you know, they can be working on the mukhaan, and all of a sudden all of that disappears. And also, you know, when you're in samadhi, when you're just watching the breath, you know, you can often feel very blissful. You know, you're in samadhi, you hear the birds sing, you feel you are the bird. You know, the world seems, it's very beautiful, very peaceful sometimes. You know, samadhi is so sweet. It's like a glass of sugar water. It's just like, oh, that is so delicious, you know. But, you know, a good Zen teacher won't let students remain too long in samadhi or they become diabetic, you know. You get so dependent on more and more sugar that you don't follow the road to enlightenment, see. You know, so, when you are watching the breath and you begin to go into that blankness, all your sweet feeling can disappear. You know, suddenly you're in this blank place, the bliss might be gone, you know, and it's just as though you're just staring, it's like looking into the Grand Canyon at night. Or maybe it's like, you know, you're in a lighted room and you open the door and you look into the next room and it's absolutely dark. You know, or it can just feel like a flat plane of darkness. But this is the foundation of all Buddhist practice. You know, the man who brought Zen to China from India, Bodhidharma, is said to have been practicing sitting in front of a wall for 9 years. And often pictures show him sitting facing a wall. And in the Soto tradition, they all sit facing a wall. That's a little bit literal-minded. You know, what he was really doing is facing that wall of mu, that blankness. And that is the door into your big mind. That's the door into your unconscious. So, you know, when you are facing mu, you are approaching your big mind. And, you know, it's never going to produce, when you're in deep mushin, you're not going to see images again, or very rarely. And it's just going to be blank. And for a while, people just feel like, well, nothing's happening. But if you keep working with the mukhan, your experience of that emptiness changes. At first, it seems just like an empty, dead void. But eventually, it's not going to be dead at all. I'm not going to say too much about this, but you need to just keep facing that blankness and trust the process. You could think about that blankness as a kind of death. I mean, when we go into that blank place, it's a little bit like dying. You know, it really is dying on the cushion. You know, and in a way, Jiaozhou or Joshu is talking about how we practice mu, sitting on the cushion and facing that emptiness. But you know, actually, mushin is not just an artificial device. You know, if you do meditation long enough, you will notice that actually mu is present in your experience from moment to moment. We just don't notice it. But it's definitely the case that there are empty blank spaces between one perception and another. So it takes a lot of meditation. But if you do a lot of meditation, you'll notice that, consciousness, our awareness of the world is not continuous. We treat it as continuous. But when your mind is in deep samadhi for a long time, you'll notice that consciousness is more like a series of images. It's like there's a moment of consciousness and then nothing, and a moment of consciousness and nothing, and a moment of consciousness and nothing. When I was a kid, we used to go to movie theaters and the projector used to break. This happens very rarely now because the technology is so good. But in the old days, a lot of theaters would have old projectors that would get too hot and they would burn the film. So you'd be running a reel of film through the projector, and if the temperature was not right, it would actually melt the acetate. And the film would break. So you'd be watching a movie and, you know, the hero would be just about to rescue the heroine, and then it would snap, you know. And just before it snapped, you'd get these flashing images, right? It was like picture, 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 and between the pictures it's just like blank screen. Actually, consciousness is like that. You know, we ignore what doesn't, we don't want to pay attention to. You know, even a movie is actually just a series of images shown very fast. And the mind, it's so fast the mind doesn't really detect the spaces. But that's true for our experience of reality too. Actually, there are these empty spaces between our moments of consciousness. So when we're doing Mushin, we're really paying attention to what we normally ignore, but which is actually there. And if you don't believe me, please just do another 5 years of meditation, and you will see that I'm telling the truth. So definitely, Mu is real. It's part of our consciousness, and when we do Mu meditation, we're paying attention to it. And, you know, there's a lesson here which is really important. You know, we have the capacity to die and become a new person. You know, we tend to think of ourselves as permanent entities. But actually, we're not permanent at all. You know, we're a collection of ideas and experiences and habits and we're also here for just a second, and then we're gone, and then we're here for just a second, and we're gone. We don't notice it. But consciousness isn't continuous, and that includes your consciousness. You know, and these moments that are empty really are crucial for dying and being reborn as a different person. You know, and when we go into emptiness, it's freeing us from all of these conditioned responses and all of this baggage we bring, and that feels like impossible to get free from. But going into Mushin is really deeply liberating. Dying on the cushion is deeply liberating. You know, really, we're constantly in flux. You know, and this is perhaps terrifying to people. It often is, right? The fact that we're not the same. It's not just that we're getting older. You know, it's that we're actually not really a solid entity at all. You know, we're like a... Have you ever seen the way when a stream flows, rocks will arrest it and it will create like a whirlpool? Well, from the Buddhist standpoint, we're really like that whirlpool. You know, we're here for a little while, and then we're gone. But that could be frightening, but it actually means we have the capacity to be very different people. You know, dying on the cushion is really important in order to become something new. You know, when you're sitting on the cushion and you're in deep Mushin, it might feel like a dead blankness, as I was saying. And this is because we don't know how to, what to do with our own openness, you know, with the openness of our existence. You know, fundamentally, this everything is here and gone, here and gone, here and gone. And when we're sitting on the cushion and we're facing that blankness, you know, it's not so much that we're changed by the blankness as, you know, we gradually learn how to be more alive in the presence of that emptiness, see? I don't know if that makes any sense, but, you know... one person could come into, everybody's sitting in the same room. We're all sitting in the same room. We all sat this morning at the same time. And one person will come in and say, I'll say, how are you doing? And the person will say, oh, not so good. You know, I really hate these rainy days. They're depressing. Yeah. And then somebody else will come in and I'll say, how's it going? They go, oh, the rain, the voice of the raindrops. You know, I love it. You know. So, you know, one person is, it's all about how you respond to things, right? One person is responding with his or her habitual ways of responding. You know, probably the person who said, the rain has me down, was already down to some degree. You know, actually, when the person, how's it going? Oh, I don't know, these rainy days are depressing. Probably already depressed, seriously. The rainy day is just sort of reminding the person that they're depressed. And the other person, you know, the person who comes in and goes, oh, I love the rain, probably would also be very happy with the sun. You know, if it was sunny coming, oh, sun, I love these sunny days, you know. So we have all of these habits that we bring to the cushion. We bring to the cushion. And they're coloring this is our karma, right? It's coloring everything we perceive, every choice we make, right? And so, you know, when we sit down on the cushion and we're in deep mushin, you know, people have different responses to that emptiness. Some people, like my student, my mysterious silent student, you know, years ago, some people just sort of hide in there. You go in there and you just say, this is comfortable, nothing's hurting me right now, I'm just going to stay in here. Some people are terrified, right? You know, when they encounter that emptiness, it's like learning to swim on a storm-tossed sea. Now, it's probably the case that they brought that mentality with them, that already fearful. So encountering emptiness just shows them their fear, right? And there are people who, you know, basically encounter that emptiness and they find it really interesting. You know, now that's interesting. Probably they find lots of things interesting, right? So you know, when you are sitting in that blankness and you're just waiting for something to happen, that's definitely the case. You have to just wait for something to happen. But, you know, your big mind is gradually going to help you to be more active in the presence of that blankness. You know, so I was in the Mu koan for a long time. You know, I sat with Mu for a number of years, and it was just like a dead blankness. And I would go to Sesshin, and Genki, everybody else was going into the Dokusan room, and in Zen tradition, you're supposed to go in and call Mu at some point. So, you know, basically you've been facing this blankness, and you're supposed to go in and go, Mu. And I would hear people go into the Dokusan room going, Mo, Mo, Mo. And I would go in there and I couldn't open my mouth. I was just paralyzed. Well, you know, I was actually paralyzed in many ways in my life. You know, I brought my paralysis to the Mu, you know. And so, you know, I sat in that paralysis for a long time. But all the time I was sitting in that blankness, my innate wisdom was actualizing, you know. And one day I went into the Dokusan room and I was able to call Mu, you know, wholeheartedly. And I thought to myself, where did that come from? You know, I, who have been dead for so long, came to life. How did that happen? You know. And of course, I had been dead long before I started working with Mu. You know, that deadness was sort of my default position. You know, so facing that blankness triggered my innate wisdom, activating innate wisdom, and eventually I was able to be present with that blankness in a whole new way. You know, so if you're working on the Mu koan and you're trying to call Mu and you feel it's silly, you know, that's definitely the way many people feel. Probably you feel lots of things are silly in life. You know, probably, you know, you're a little bit worried about being a standout. You know. If you might be like me and you might just be sitting there in a dead void, Maybe you're feeling the vibe, and that you probably feel the vibe in other ways too. But if you don't, you know, your innate wisdom is going to help you deal with the emptiness of things. You know, it's another way of putting it, you know, what are we going to do? You know, none of us is going to be here in 60 years, or let's say 70 years, 80. So I always say, I've just finished my first 40 years of Zen, and I'm looking forward to my next 40 years of Zen. But it may not work out, you know, it may not work out that way. But the great Zen master, Joshu, lived to be 120 years old, Jiaozhou. So we all want to be like Joshu, right? You know. However, another great Zen master, Lin Ji, lived to be 51. Right. So naturally, we'd rather be Jiaozhou than Lin Ji. But if you say, who really changed Buddhism in China? It's Lin Ji. You know, so we can't control how long we're here, and we can't control the circumstances under which we're here, right? You know, none of us chooses to be, to have diabetes, or to have immune disorder, or any, we don't get to choose, you know, we get dealt these cards. But how we play the hand, you know, what we do with the cards, you know, is what Zen is all about. You know, you learn how to be, you know, playing open-heartedly. And that allows you to be creative. And also you realize, you know, the point probably isn't to win the game. You know, it's to enjoy playing the game. And in fact, in a way, the point of the game is to let others win. You know, let others win. Look how much pleasure it gives them. You know, so a lot of Zen is about learning the art of self-transformation. Self-transformation. We're here for a little while. We all get trapped in the identities we have created, you know, been given. We can spend our lives trapped, or we can start exploring. We can be very different people. You know, the Buddhist view is that we live many lives. And, you know, in some religious traditions, the idea that you live many lives is considered like a terrible thing. It's like, get off the wheel. But in Mahayana Buddhism, you know, we want to live many lives, helping others. In other words, you know, every time you go into that emptiness, something new can happen if you make yourself available to your innate wisdom. You know, this is like a great adventure. You know, being alive is so easy to be dead, right? So easy, no problems. You know, but being alive is, as soon as you're alive, it's like a ball in a, you know, you're like a ball thrown into a bubbling stream. You know, it's just bouncing around, hitting rocks. But you know, this is a great opportunity, right? And the Buddhist view is that, you know, people can expand, change and change and grow. And the world can become bigger and bigger in ways we can't really imagine when we start. You know. So basically Zen is an art of dying and also like art of living. You know, art of living. So please start dying, and please start living. Jiaozhou asked Tuzhou, when someone who has undergone the great death then returns to life, how is it? Tuzhou said, he can't go by night. He should arrive in daylight. You know, you need to go into Muxing, but don't linger. You know, linger. You know, you need to transform yourself and come alive.